resources again that I'm going to. Thanks for tuning in. Thanks for supporting through these tough times. We got the Power to the Tower campaign. There's some technicians coming down in the middle of next week, and hopefully that might resolve some of the issues that are ongoing. And let's hear from Mumia straight away here. I was calling for him to be released along with Leonard Peltier. Leonard Peltier is confined to a 100-mile radius, so I was talking about how he's not free. He's in house arrest, but he gets to roam the res, apparently.
I remember you with sheer joy because every time I saw you, there was a smile on your face. You were chewing bubble gum like it was gone out of style. And you were either working to create a piece of art or working to reproduce it so it could be put on the cover of probably the most famous revolutionary newspaper of the 1960s, the Black Panther. You were a marvel then. You are a marvel now. And I remembered you with such warmth. When I worked at National, you were one of my heroes as an artist, as a cultural figure. And I thank you for being Emory Douglas. And I appreciate you, and I admire you, and I love you. This is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
Urban surveys, Pew, for example. This is not new news, but as it's a lingering and constantly growing problem. Question.
Well, we're going to have some old news here, some old news, some new news.
Post-haste, as well as the root problem.
There we go.
Root problem is a statewide.
We'll kick it off as we usually do with
more so in the offices of Virginia's Commonwealth Attorney.
The
allegations of corruption and wrongdoing have been levied against the majority.
Commentary breaking the sound barrier from Amy Goodman. She was busy this week. She's got a lot of stuff up on
the law to be self-serving.
The web exclusive, and since I'm suffering from the maladies of our times,
people such as Charles Philip Ferguson of Suffolk, who became an equally questionable judge, now a member of the recently exposed and under fire Virginia Pardon Parole Board. Nicole Balut of Norfolk, Elizabeth K. Dillon, a federal judge in Virginia's Western District, Michael Doshea of Lynchburg, and the infamous William Eric Branson of Floyd County, all of whom have been ousted by victims of colleague Beloit, along with Norman Thomas as well.
All right, let's kick it with breaking the sound barrier.
All the way up to the Virginia AG, Jason Harris.
Office. Got some Dean Baker. I played it last week. I do a more international show, but since mucking the international economy and the tariffs, et cetera, is a global issue, CEPR.net, co-founded with Mark Weisbrot, who is a friend of this ground. He is publishing a little bit these days. He's got a byline along with the economist worse, Joseph Stiglitz and one of his latest essays up at that
to
site.
Exposure and embarrassment. You want to track what he's considering. Statewide shakeup is desperately needed, and investigations are being asked for at all corners. Thank you very much. My name is David Annarelli, contributing writer to Prison Journalism Project. You can find me at davidannarelli.wordpress.org, as well as all over the internet. Just Google my name. Thank you.
These commentaries are recorded by Prison Radio.
In Colorado by ICE agents who were reportedly laughing in her face as they took her to the Aurora ICE jail run by the for-profit GEO Group. As this goes to print, she remains locked up, facing deportation. For almost 30 years, Jeanette Vizgueta has built a life in this country, becoming a well-known organizer and activist for immigrant rights and other social justice causes. Her arrest signals a clear trend targeting activists as part of President Donald Trump's promised mass deportation campaign. Jeanette and her husband and six-year-old daughter fled Mexico in 1997 after he was threatened with murder at gunpoint. They settled in Colorado. There, she worked as an SEIU labor organizer, volunteered with the Colorado Immigrant Rights Coalition and the American Friends Service Committee, and founded the activist organizations Dreamers Mothers and Action Colorado, Abolish ICE Denver, and Sanctuary for All. She did all this while working numerous jobs and giving birth to and raising three more children, all born in the U.S. In 2009, Jeanette Vizgueta successfully fought deportation following a routine traffic stop. Then, in 2017, during the first Trump administration, she was targeted for deportation and took sanctuary in a Unitarian church in Denver, living there with her three young children. She received a stay of removal, but then, upon its expiration in 2019, returned to sanctuary. She received additional deportation stays during the Biden administration, but those have expired, leaving her vulnerable to Trump's deportation crusade. At a rally on Tuesday, as high winds drove a mix of freezing rain and snow into the crowd of close to 100 supporters rallying outside the walls of the Geo ICE jail in Aurora, Jeanette managed to address the crowd by phone from inside. Her daughter, Luna Baez, held the phone up to a microphone.
I'm hopeful I'm going to be able to leave here and continue my fighting for others, because inside here there are many injustices. There are a lot of women that their cases are not being reviewed, and I'm going to try to help them, even being here in detention.
To those who know Jeanette, it comes as no surprise she was actively organizing inside the prison walls.
Any other reason why they might be targeting Jeanette? She's long been a leader.
Jennifer Piper of the American Friends Service Committee said on the Democracy Now! NewsHour.
She was the first person in the country, among the first to make her deportation case public in 2009 and really expose the machinery and the cruelty of our deportation machine, which is vast in the United States. And no matter who the administration was, Jeanette has always stood and will continue to stand for justice and for dignity for all people.
Piper says there's increasing fear among immigrants of the Trump administration disappearing people. Margaret Cargioli, an attorney with the Immigrant Defenders Law Center, speaking on Democracy Now!, described the case of an LGBTQ asylum seeker from Venezuela. Only after he failed to arrive at an immigration hearing on Monday did she learn that he'd been sent by ICE to El Salvador's notorious Supermax Terrorism Detention Center, or CECOT. Watchdog groups in El Salvador report at least 350 people have died in prisons there since 2022, and torture is reportedly common inside CECOT.
We are seriously concerned for his well-being, his safety. There was no order of deportation. There was no order of removal. He was not deported. He was sent there unlawfully. He still has a pending immigration court hearing. It's coming up very soon, and he has a right to seek asylum. What happened here is extremely unusual and concerning.
The Trump administration has invoked the more than two-century-old 1798 Alien Enemies Act, last used during World War II, to send over 130 Venezuelans alleged to be members of the Tren de Aragua gang without evidence to CECOT. Trump is using the extreme right-wing government of Salvadoran President Nayib Bukele as a brutal detention contractor. As with many of Trump's executive orders, this is being challenged in court. Trump's open defiance of Judge James Boasberg's court order halting use of the 1798 law to round up migrants is pushing the United States into a constitutional crisis. The detentions, deportations, and disappearances are stoking fear in the immigrant community, which is certainly one of its main objectives. One who remains undaunted is Jeanette Vizguera.
Over her entire case, her entire fight of the last 16 years, every moment, her struggle and her leadership, her community have made the impossible possible.
The AFSC's Jennifer Piper said Jeanette Vizguera should be an example to citizens and non-citizens alike. I'm Amy Goodman with Dennis Moynihan.
Okay. Yeah, they couldn't turn the planes around, even though they were over the Gulf of America. That was my quip. And I just heard a feature about Trump's quote, not Trump, Musk's quote, about the flaw in Western civilization, that is its empathy. We're in a suicidal civilizational empathy that's going on, he said on the Joe Rogan show. Amazing. And then that a lot of Christian groups are de-emphasizing empathy, saying it's a part of the gynocracy that we're in. Too much women's influence on the polity, apparently, in their view. It's pretty amazing stuff, the times we live in. Okay, queuing up. I think I'll start with Dean Baker. I hope I can, might have to excerpt this on the fly. The last point he makes hits me where I live because I was a son of a Ralston Purina dealer in my youth, back in rural Illinois, down in rural Illinois. And he has some insights about a number of things. And I guess we're probably not going to get to that, so I'm saying it now. The different in agricultural husbandry and animal husbandry, chickens, they aren't in the largest groups. that they are here in the U.S. and Canada, and that's maybe why they haven't had to kill so many of them and why the price of eggs is lower in Canada than it is here. So, yeah, interesting that The Economist has insight into U.S. agriculture vis-a-vis Canadian agriculture. I guess they have to be, even though it's a dismal science. Uh-oh. That was the wrong cut. Maybe this one's it. Yeah. Sorry about that. I'm, like I say, struggling with the times. It's insomniacal times.
Show on KPFA. I am Philip Muldery. My guest is Dean Baker. Dean is senior economist at the Center for Economic and Policy Research. Their website is cepr.net, cepr.net for Center for Economic and Policy Research. We're going to open the phones in 20 minutes to your called-in questions and comments. Do wait until 10:30 before you place your call to get in the queue. The phone number is 1-800-958-9008.
I thought I edited that out.
The Dems took quite a hit. In the so-called industrial heartland of this country, losing all of those states from Ohio, Indiana, Wisconsin, Michigan. Largely, what you heard from the sound bites was, what have the Democrats ever done for us? Why not give Trump a chance? Are the Democrats responsible for tying a can to blue-collar workers in this country?
Well, I'd say they share responsibility, and for better or worse, they're associated with very anti-working class policies, specifically because you had Bill Clinton in the White House with the two biggest trade measures that did hurt workers, NAFTA back in 1993, and then allowing China into WTO in 2000. Again, Republicans supported that. NAFTA was largely negotiated by George H.W. Bush. More Republicans voted for it in Congress than Democrats. Bringing China into WTO again, more Republicans voted for that in Congress than Democrats. But there was Bill Clinton. So it's pretty hard to say the Democrats don't bear responsibility for that. You can point to the Republicans and say, well, they were on board. But people see Bill Clinton. And for what it's worth, the Republicans with Trump no longer endorse those policies. So, they have someone to blame there. And then also fostering the bloated financial sector, both with deregulation. I shouldn't say deregulation. I should put partial deregulation because the government always stands ready to bail out the financial sector when they get themselves in trouble, which they do repeatedly. So, of course, we all know about 2008, 2009, when, again, the Democrats rushed to bail them out. Republicans supported it too, of course. But the Democrats, 2009, there was Barack Obama supporting the bailouts. And, in fact, in the 2008, before he was even president, they had a tough time getting the bailout, original bailout bill through Congress. Obama called up all the waiting members and said, hey, you know, you have to do this. You have to do this. So they do have a lot to blame the Democrats for. And I wrote a piece a few weeks ago saying Democrats should make an apology. They should apologize for trade talks. Throw Bill Clinton under the bus. You know, say, I mean, again, you can't reverse it. You can't be Donald Trump and say we're going to bring us back to where we were 30 or 40 years ago. We don't have the power to do that. The world's changed. You can't do that. But at least acknowledge it was a mistake. And I can't blame people for being upset at the Democrats for saying, hey, look what you did. You know, horrible trade policy. You supported the bloated financial sector. And I can't blame someone for being mad about that.
Well, it's hard for me to imagine keeping China out of world trade. It seems like, even though it was very negative for U.S. workers, I mean, China, we have to acknowledge its existence. It might be the largest economy in the world right now. It's certainly a close second to the United States. I mean, we can't just pretend that we can punish China and they will stop underselling us. I remember Obama invested in rooftop solar units in a company right here in the Bay Area when lo and behold, it turned out that the Chinese were underselling us for every one of those units by 50%. And who's gonna buy an American product that costs twice as much as the Chinese product and is essentially its equal? I mean, we can't just pretend that everything will be okay if we're just mean to China.
No, I'm not advocating. Let me make a couple points here. Going back 25 years, so 2000, we hold the chips. So the U.S. really decides whether China gets in WTO. We weren't freezing them on international trade by any means in any case, because they were already doing a lot of trade. And also, I should point out, they were growing very rapidly. So I've heard a lot of people say, well, look at how prosperous China is. Isn't it a great thing that a billion people have been lifted up into, you know, decent living standards from being a very poor country? And if you go back to the 70s, China was at sub-Saharan Africa level of standard living. So, you know, and to my mind, absolutely, it's a fantastic thing. But it was already growing very rapidly. So if you look at its growth from 1980 to 2020, it was actually slightly more rapid than it was from 2000 to 2020. So it didn't obviously speed up their growth. But again, opening them up to trade, again, we could have set conditions on it. We could have protected our market more so that we didn't see this rapid inflow of Chinese manufactured goods wiping out large sections of our industry. We had the power to do that. We didn't. So that was a very bad mistake. But again, this is history. So where are we today? Well, yeah, we can get a lot of goods from China, half the price. I've been touting on my social media that China's got what looks to be a pretty good EV. I've never driven it, but by accounts looks to be a pretty good EV that you can get for $13,000. Can you imagine being able to get a good EV for $13,000? I mean, that'd be incredible. And so I think what we should do is allow some of those into the country. We don't want to wipe out our industry, arrange for tech transfers because they're ahead of us. That's the reality. They're ahead of us in EVs. They're ahead of us in battery technology. They're ahead of us in solar technology. So let's try to build up our own sector some. You know, again, give some of the supports. Biden, I think, was on the right path there, but also arrange for tech transfer. They're not the enemy. I mean, we might have conflicts with them in lots of different areas, but selling us low-cost EVs and clean energy, that's not an act of war.
Elon Musk may, in fact, be engaged in an act of war. So let's talk a bit about Tesla stock cratering since December and losing a third of its value. We're talking about Tesla's no longer being desirable in Europe at all. 94% of Germans said they would never buy a Tesla. And in fact, here in the Bay Area, which has the largest Tesla factory in the U.S., Tesla showrooms are every Saturday inundated by demonstrations of outraged people. And Tesla owners are now desperately attempting to cover their tracks for having bought a car from this fascist. What of Elon Musk, the brilliant richest man in the world? Any chance we can knock him off his pedestal?
He has been knocked off. I think he needs to be further knocked off, obviously. I mean, separating him from Trump, I think, would be a tremendous victory. Because basically they have a checkmate here where you have a lot of Republicans. I mean, you have some number of Republicans in the House and Senate are total, whatever, lackeys, whatever you want to call them. Trump calls them up, tells them to do X, Y, and Z. They go, yes, sir, without reservation. I mean, they take their marching orders. But many of them are somewhat thoughtful people. They might not be great intellectuals or anything, but they know what he is, and they don't like it. And they're in a situation now where if they were to stand up to Trump, Trump goes, well, you should really do what I say, or I'm going to yell at you on social media, this and that. But the big thing is they go, well, Elon Musk is going to put infinite money into your primary opponent. And that scares a politician, needless to say. If you could separate Musk from Trump so that they don't have to worry that their primary opponent's going to have infinite money. They'll have money, but the issue with Musk is it's an order of magnitude higher. So that's a big thing. And one of the ironies, of course, of Tesla is that the people who bought Teslas were overwhelmingly Democrats. There were people who cared about global warming Trump actually very openly in his campaign. He was contemptuous. You know, well, electric cars, they don't go anywhere. They have no range. They don't work in cold weather and whatever, whatever, whatever. So if you're a good American, of course, you got a gas guzzler. So the people who bought his cars are people who are most disgusted by what he's been doing since Trump got in the White House. So, yeah, he's taking a big hit. Taking a big hit overseas, just being out competing in China. I don't know what the rhetoric there. I don't know if there's an anti-Musk sentiment in China or not, but some of the reality is the Chinese electric vehicles are much better and cheaper. So he's could take a big hit. Now, the other side, of course, is he's using his ties to Trump to foster his other businesses, well, also Tesla, too. Trump did an ad for him last week, but also Starlink, SpaceX, he's looking to get Trump to foster those businesses with government contracts, which he seems to be getting. So that will be an offset. But certainly if Tesla goes down the tubes, which it seems it might, that will be a big hit to Musk.
Dean, it seems like the industrial European countries, particularly Germany, are really going through a rough period. So it's not just the U.S., but we're talking about the Germans, largely the industrial powerhouse of Europe, clearly in trouble right now. Even though they're getting a new government, not much is going to change. I don't know about the Japanese economy, whether they're in trouble also. So in general, are we talking about these industrial powerhouses now somehow being on their back foot? What's the story?
Well, Germany, their biggest problem was self-imposed. So they're nuts. They have this obsession with austerity. They're fearful of inflation. I've talked to many German economists, not someone I grabbed off the street. And they just say, well, it's just, you know, we had inflation back in 220 in Weimar and we got Hitler, so we know we can't have inflation. And I'm just going, those are kind of unique events. And it doesn't always lead to Hitler. And we're not talking about hyperinflation. But they have had this obsession that they couldn't run deficits, they couldn't have any inflation. And those haven't gone away. But one of the things I was very, very encouraged by, and really didn't get that much press here, but their new government, it's a Christian Democrat government, so it's conservative. It's not Trumpy, but it's a center-right conservative government. I guess the Social Democrats will be the junior partner, so the more left-wing party. But again, left-center, they're not radical leftists by any means. But they got Germany's debt break. So this was a rule that, again, I don't know what it's in their constitution, their basic law, overriding normal laws, that said they could not have large deficits. And they got that changed in the outgoing parliament. And what that means is they could spend more on building up their infrastructure. They want to build up their military, which we're nearly not sympathetic to. But in this case, given that they might need to protect themselves not only from Russia, but maybe the United States, I think that probably is reasonable policy. And also spending more on climate initiatives. The Greens insisted on that, and they got that in. So I think we're going to see Germany have somewhat of a revival in coming months with the new government. And again, they're not any radical left government or radical of any stripe, but they recognize the problem they're facing. And I think they're prepared to take decisive measures. And Germany, of course, is the biggest economy in Europe. And that I think will have a big effect.
Well, I quite frankly am very cautious. With Trump more or less denouncing traditional allies like Western Europe, the NATO countries. It's also possible the NATO countries will stop buying U.S. military equipment, which is probably the largest moneymaker on foreign trade that the U.S. has, aside from services. Is he more or less shooting himself in the foot by attacking European former allies?
I would say he is. Again, he's yelling about unfair trade. And I mean, his first target, of course, is Canada. He was claiming we have a $200 billion trade deficit with him. We actually have a $60 billion trade deficit. And all of it's oil, which he was actually facilitating. You go back to his first term, he was the big advocate of the XL, the pipeline, make it easier to export Canadian oil into the United States. So again, going to Europe, what's our beef with Europe? We have a trade deficit with them. So what? It's utterly absurd. So he's making enemies out of allies. And again, we could argue about his policies towards Russia and everything, but it's a little weird that we have at least a sensible, again, I'm not a Russia hawk either, but we have at least a sensible enemy in the case of Russia that is now his good friend. And we've turned Canada and Europe into our big enemies. It's a little crazy. There's no reason for these countries to be our enemies. You always negotiate, you get the just trade deals, but it's not as though they're horribly unfair now. He's kind of hallucinating. One of the things he's been saying, we'll have to see whether he follows through on it. He's saying we want to reciprocal tariffs. And what he's regarding, at least he said, again, we'll see what he does, what he's regarding as a tariff is the value-added tax that they have in Europe. So most European countries, and probably all of them, have value-added tax. It's a sales tax. That's not a tariff. So it's on their goods as well. So if you buy a TV that was made in Germany, you're going to pay, I don't know, 15% value-added tax. I'm sure it's not the right number, but you pay 15%. If you were to buy a TV that were made in the U.S., you pay a 15% value-added tax. That's not a tax on imports. It's a tax on everything you buy. But he said that's unfair. You know, so it's, again, I have no idea what's in his head, what he hopes to accomplish, but outwardly it makes zero sense.
Zero sense. Sorry I played that so fast. He talks pretty fast already. Maybe the next speaker, not so much. Yeah, I know there's a lot of things to decry, but this one's getting lost in the weeds. I didn't hear this until just recently from Dean Baker, we heard there with Philip Maldery. The VAT tax is a sales tax. It's made a little more progressive because people in the lower income ranges can file and get a rebate on their taxes. And tourists, which maybe the people that Trump talks to are the people that go shopping abroad. My trips abroad never include shopping trips. But tourists can also get a rebate on their VAT payments. And I guess it matters if you're buying high-ticket items abroad, which it can't be a lot of the economy. And if he wants to call that an unfair subsidy, I guess maybe he could, but it's minuscule compared to the amount of trade. Anyway, that's much too much in the weeds. I decided to go on with a web exclusive from Democracy Now! It was part two of Wolfgang Kallak, a German, sort of aligned with the Center for Constitutional Rights. Wide-ranging discussion. I have this little excerpt that starts with Juan Gonzalez asking about military spending in the EU, and that's a good follow-on. Apparently, Juan Gonzalez was in town twice in the last academic year, in the fall, and then just recently in the spring, and I didn't hear about it. These units on campus are so insular, is what I think is happening. Anyway, here is another complexity, but yeah, let's hear from Juan Gonzalez here right now. Oh, actually, since I am in a brief interlude, why don't I do an underwriting announcement? I'll be editing on the fly. I always let you know. These are all, the rest of the segments are all web exclusives from Democracy Now! She's been busy and keeps her spirits up despite everything.
Programming on WEFT is made possible in part by Common Ground Food Co-op. Located in Lincoln Square Mall, Common Ground is Champaign-Urbana's only community-owned grocery store, specializing in local and organic foods. All are welcome and no membership is required to shop at the Common Ground Food Co-op.
It's a step backwards.
Yeah,
I also wanted to ask you about the growing move in Europe for more military spending as a result of the rift with the United States, and the possibility that some countries in Europe may be the guarantors of any peace between Russia and Ukraine. Do you have concerns that increasing military spending in Germany and France and Britain will eventually collide with human rights needs, and not only that, the social welfare needs of the people of Europe?
Of course, I have these concerns. I mean, it's a crazy world where, you know, we need to face the climate catastrophe. We need to strengthen the welfare state. We need to combat inequality in all our countries, but also in the world. The inequality between global northern and global southern country, and instead of doing that, we have to spend money in for military. That has to be. It is frightening for us. I can only see in Germany. It's very interesting because the package, the big package that just which just passed the German parliament, which was designed by the upcoming Chancellor Friedrich Merz and the Social Democrats, and agreed to by the Green Party, includes also $500 million. Investments into infrastructure and even into climate. And that is something, you know, progressive economists demanded from Germany for the last couple of years. And it was the neoliberal party in the parliament who stood in the way of these necessary investments. So, you know, it's painful to see that money is spent for military, and we have to discuss the details. We also have to discuss the question who's profiting, because I mean it's the society, it's all of us who have to pay for that, and it's not justified that those who are producing the arms, the corporations, gain immense profits from that. That has to be discussed, but I think for many reasons you just mentioned, it's necessary that Europe establish military and political power to confront Russia, because Russia under Putin is an imminent danger for Ukraine, for Eastern European members of the European Union, and at the end of the day also for the Western European countries.
Wolfgang Kulik, you are giving a speech at the New School titled Double Standards in International Law. I'm wondering if you can, you know, you have a previous book called Law Versus Power, Our Global Fight for Human Rights. If you can talk, put these two together and also talk about what's happening in Germany right now. I mean, in the United States, there were protests across the country for the arrest, putting in ICE detention of Mahmoud Khalil, who is involved with the Gaza protests on Columbia University campus. He's had his green card revoked. I mean, you have a similar situation in Germany, and I'm wondering if you can talk about the repression of free speech when it comes to criticism of Israel and the conflation of criticism of the Israeli military bombardment and war on Gaza with anti-Semitism.
So first of all, I would like to start with the positive developments. And the positive development in the last 1.5 years was that the most important legal institutions, the International Court of Justice in The Hague and the International Criminal Court in The Hague, took up this issue. The ICC issued arrest warrants, amongst others, against Netanyahu, and the International Court of Justice in the very important South Africa case also put some requests to Israel, and it's not yet decided. So these are mind-blowing and paradigm-shifting decisions of the two bodies, because in a very difficult situation, they proved that they have the ambition to really exercise universal jurisdiction. So Germany's stand to that, the German government's stand, was very ambivalent, because on the one hand, they are arguing that they are endorsing the international rule-based order, and on the other hand, they were on the side of Israel as well in the ICJ case as in the ICC case. And that is, for me, the most important critique. The second thing which is on stake is arms export. And that is something we are litigating against. And that's also very interesting because people think, and there was even another case in The Hague against Germany's arms export. But in fact, Germany's arms export to Israel was on is on decline. There were no heavy arms, war weapons exported in the last couple of months. And that was partly, they say, governments also say, due to our legal efforts and due to legal concerns. And that is something I want to put in the forefront, that law can play an important role. And then your question on protest. Obviously, we have to state that there are shrinking spaces for civil society, for protest all over the place. And that includes Germany. It was not only the Gaza protest, but it was before we had also police repression against the climate protest. And that's really, really concerning. And we had cancellations of events of public intellectuals from all over the world who were awarded, who were invited to Germany, and they canceled their events. On the other side, we have to say, I mean, it's not true that there is no place, there are no space for Israel critic in Germany. We're having events where the papers are full of accounts of critique, but you know the consequences are not to be seen. I mean, if politicians would accurately read what's happening in Gaza and now more and more also on the West Bank, they should draw the consequences, and that is to stop their support for the government of Netanyahu. And that is something which seems to be very difficult in Germany. But I think the situation is not so much because of Germany's history, because of the Holocaust, but it's not so much different from the UK and from the US.
I wanted to ask you about President Trump's repeated statements that he's in favor of removing Palestinians from Gaza, something that clearly Prime Minister Netanyahu vociferously has supported as well. Is it your sense that the United States is approaching a rogue status in world affairs with these kinds of policy prescriptions?
I mean, we're talking about ethnic cleansing, and obviously that's an international crime. And there is not much more to be said about that. I mean, it's shameful that this proposal is obviously seriously on the table. I mean, we can only say that all those who are supporting this proposal will have to face accusations of adding and abetting international crimes, may it be war crimes, may it be crimes against humanity, or may you call it a genocide. And that's then on stake. So it's not only about this administration, it's also about all the governments and all those corporations who are supporting this proposal.
Wolfgang Kallak, I want to thank you so much for being with us, General Secretary of the European Center for Constitutional and Human Rights. He's usually in Berlin, in Germany, but here in New York to give a speech at the New School. This is
Oh, my. Too many lights on the board here. I hope you had some time to think about that, and I can't recapitulate what I've just been talking about too much. I do want to mention that there is speaking of demos in the Mahbub Khalil case, there is a demo on the south patio of the university campus. That's 12 to 1 Monday next. So hope the bright light of the sun is shining on that. The obviously related issues are protection of free speech and academic rights, for academic freedom, protection for international and undocumented university community, and divestment from corporations committing human rights violation. March 3rd, further down the line, there's a demo about the attacks on education. So some concerted action. Sorry again, I'm just a little too fuzzy. I've been talking about excerpting the interview, a web exclusive with the New York Times journalist Enrich. He's a business investigative reporter, and he's actually pretty good. He has a book out called Murdering the Truth or something like that. But first, Peter Kornbluh of the National Security Archives. Yeah, maybe just enough time to get most of this on. And sorry about the blank spot there.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As we continue with part two, a web exclusive talking to Peter Kornbluh at the National Security Archive about the federal government releasing around 80,000 pages of documents related to the 1963 assassination of President John F. Kennedy. Some say the documents have revealed few new revelations on the assassination, but these unredacted files are filled with details about covert CIA operations around the world, from the Vatican to Latin America. So we continue now with Peter Kornbluh, senior analyst for Latin America at the National Security Archive. He's researched CIA operations for decades with a focus on Latin America. We've interviewed him on his books like Back Channel to Cuba, The Hidden History of Negotiations Between Washington and Havana, and Bay of Pigs Declassified, the secret CIA report on the invasion of Cuba. He is joining us from Wellfleet, Massachusetts. Peter, thank you so much for staying with us. Let's start off by you responding to President Trump releasing these tens of thousands of pages on the JFK assassination in attempt to show that the administration is, quote, the most transparent administration in history. Your thoughts on this and how this all came about?
There's really three parts to the whole discussion of the JFK papers that have come out this week. One is the content that has been revealed in these long-held secret documents. We are getting to the final secrets that for all these years, the CIA and the FBI and others have resisted releasing since the JFK law was passed back in 1992, so many years ago. And that's the second part of the discussion, the law itself, a precedent-setting law forcing the declassification of information, documentation, secrets that probably would have stayed classified for eternity had not this law been passed and forced them into the public domain. And the final part of the discussion about these papers is Donald Trump's efforts to politicize and weaponize his decision to finally fully implement the law. He's now casting himself as the transparency president. And of course, if you look at what he's done during the first 2 months he's been back in the White House, he's been anything but transparent. And he is systematically shutting down the American public's right to know what is being done in its name, but really without its knowledge.
Where does Tulsi Gabbard fit into this picture?
Well, she is now the unqualified head of national intelligence. She is director of national intelligence. She's the highest intelligence officer in the country, even overseeing CIA, FBI, NSA, all the intelligence services. She's a coordinator of intelligence. And she came out this week and said that Donald Trump is ushering in a new era of maximum transparency. I mean, this is really one of those alternative facts that we got used to during the first Trump administration, because in these first 2 months, you know, President Trump has started to simply erase websites that the U.S. government had on various issues, from climate change to education to civil rights. He is basically firing the staffs of major information facilities, including the National Archives itself, reducing the ability for us to access historical documents. And of course, there's much that's going on in secret, and the Freedom of Information Act offices are being reduced in all the agencies as well. So overall, the public's access to information is being gutted, frankly, being challenged by this administration. And, you know, the release of the JFK documents has proved beneficial for him to spin the idea that he's all about openness and transparency.
I'm wondering if you can talk about who DCI John McCone is and his involvement in everything from the Vatican to the agency's covert financial support to political parties and the fight against communism, unquote.
John McCone was a very famous, accomplished businessman. He was on the board of AT&T, one of the biggest corporations in the world in the early 60s. After the failure of the Bay of Pigs, John F. Kennedy fired the director of Central Intelligence, Alan Dulles, basically pushed him to retire. And Kennedy appointed John McCone in his place to be director of Central Intelligence. So McCone shows up in a lot of these documents that have been declassified because he was director of Central Intelligence at the time of the Kennedy assassination. And many of the documents are from that era, 1961 through 1963, 64, 65. So a number of the documents are there. And one of the great documents that my organization, the National Security Archive, posted this week is a document from what was called the Family Jewels, reports from inside the CIA on the CIA's own misconduct and criminality from the early 1970s. And one of McCone's top aides, Walter Elder, wrote a document, a report to Director William Colby in 1973 that kind of recounted all the questionable and misconduct that he was aware of. And among that, the revelations in that document that came out this week was that John McCone was involved in various communications with the Vatican that, according to Elder, would raise eyebrows, could and would raise eyebrows. According to the document, and that he was in touch with two popes during those years. This opens the door to kind of a whole history that is unknown of CIA connections to the Vatican and to what degree the Vatican was assisting CIA covert operations around the world. And that is a history that really is unknown and begs for revelation.
Can you talk about what you learned about Cuba in the Kennedy assassination files that have been released? I mean, you who know so much about it, what really shocked you and surprised you in these tens of thousands of pages, if you've gotten through all of them or most of them?
Well, nothing shocked me or surprised me because we already have an extraordinarily infamous history that we know about, deriving mostly from the Church Committee, you know, investigations of the mid-1970s. And many of those documents that the Church Committee saw on Cuba, on efforts to assassinate Castro, on covert operations against Cuba, you know, many of those are included in this Kennedy collection because Cuba was, you know, identified by the right wingers as part of the conspiracy against Kennedy. And then on the left, you know, the idea was that the CIA killed Kennedy because he abandoned them at the Bay of Pigs. I mean, all the conspiracy theories have Cuba in the middle of them one way or another. So a lot of the Cuba documents were included in the JFK collection. And we've learned new details. We've learned how the CIA goes about contaminating a cargo load of sugar exports from Cuba to the USSR, how they managed to get into a warehouse where the sugar was stored before it was being loaded on the boat, contaminated 800 bags, and wrote about in its reports on its successes against Cuba, you know, how this entire expensive load of sugar would get to the USSR. And when it was all put together, it would be completely ruined. And everybody who drank sugar or used it in their coffee or put it in their meals would hate it. And this would, you know, basically destroy, you know, Cuba's ability to send sugar to the USSR. I mean, those are incredibly interesting details. We've learned that many countries that we didn't know about were supporting secretly CIA covert operations against Cuba. And that's
which countries,
be very
Peter?
Important. Well, the countries ranged from Canada to Mexico to Greece and Spain and England and a number of others. You know, again, this is old history from the early 60s, but it certainly will be interesting for the citizens of those countries to know that history and perhaps push to learn more about it from their own governments.
Peter, can you talk about how Oliver Stone's movie blockbuster JFK led to Congress passing the 1992 JFK Act and how your organization, the National Security Archive, played a role in sorting through the millions of documents that have been released since then about JFK's assassination?
You know, the JFK Act, Records Act, is so important, and I can't stress this enough. It should be a precedent, should be a model for other major declassifications of collections of documents. And the entire law and the whole ability of us to access these documents today derives from a conspiracy-laden movie that Oliver Stone made in the early 1990s, simply called JFK. Many of your audience, I'm sure, saw the movie. The movie was about a district attorney in New Orleans, James Garrison, and his efforts to prosecute a local businessman there for killing JFK, and then his expansion of his conspiracy theories to include the CIA and the FBI. His efforts to prosecute people there led to, I think, the suicide of one of the defendants and the acquittal in like less than an hour of another defendant. And so it was all bogus. It was just a malicious, cruel, and baseless prosecution. But conspiracy theorists kind of, you know, found it compelling. And Oliver Stone thought it was good enough to cast Kevin Costner as James Garrison and make a whole movie about it. At the very end of the movie, a scroll comes up on the dark screen saying that none of the documents relating to the investigation of Kennedy and the Kennedy assassination have been declassified. And that there were an estimated 5 million pages that were still secret after 30 years. And this outraged the American public. I mean, I think the movie captured the conspiracy-minded sense that, you know, secrecy was bad and something was being hidden about who really killed John Kennedy.
Because at the time, it was 30 years after the assassination.
Yes, it was just short of 30 years after the assassination when the movie came out. That's right. And you know, it was incomprehensible that the secrecy was still there. In fact, the secrecy itself was contaminating the American public, society, our institutions. There was no confidence in government, very similar to what we have now that's being stoked by President Trump. And so to try and rebuild the confidence in the Congress realized that it had to be transparent and pass a law that really forced the declassification, the full declassification of these documents, millions of pages, creating an independent board to oversee them, defining a Kennedy assassination-related record in very broad terms that has led to including all these CIA and FBI records that we might not otherwise have seen. And, you know, this is extremely important. It has yielded so much incredible information. It literally has lifted the shroud of secrecy over CIA covert operations around the world in a way that we never would have learned about without this particular law.
Finally, Peter Kornbluh, if you could give Trump a list of government documents that you want to see declassified, what would be some of the top documents you want out?
Well, we'd like to see declassified, at least in part, all the documents that he took when he left office after his first term that he took to Mar-a-Lago and that he attempted to keep even after the U.S. government, the National Archives, asked him to return them. We would like
and
to see.
He apparently, by the way, you heard that he apparently took those documents back now and sent them back to Mar-a-Lago.
Yes, they've been returned to him. Which in itself raises a lot of issues, legal issues, about highly classified records being not secure at his estate in Florida. We would like to know about what his conversations with Vladimir Putin were about. You'll remember an incident where he had a private conversation in Europe with Putin, and the interpreter was there, and he took the interpreter's notes afterwards and walked off with them. We would like those notes. We would like any memcons, memorandum of conversation, of all the conversations he's had with Vladimir Putin. We would certainly like to see many of the discussions that he had in the Oval Office about January 6th, both before, during, and after. There's quite a record. In my case, I would like to see the documents that he used to put Cuba on the terrorism list, which where it doesn't belong. I think those were politicized, and someday we'll get those declassified, I hope. And of course, we'd like to know about his, you know, covert policies, and we'd like to know what's going on today vis-a-vis covert operations against Cuba and Venezuela and many other countries.
Peter Kornblum, we want to thank you so much for spending this time. Senior analyst for Latin America at the National Security Archive, co-editor of the recent report, CIA Covert Ops, Kennedy Assassination Records Lift Veil of Secrecy. We will link to your piece coming out in The Nation magazine today. And if you want to see part one of our discussion with Peter, go to democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
And that's where you can go to hear the entirety of that, as well as the entirety of the next one and the other two segments. And there's also one that she put up. This is a banner week for her, an extra product, an interview with some musicians who were at the Kennedy Center in protesting the takeover. All right. Now last excerpt, and this is with the New York Times journalist, Murder the Truth is the book. Surprisingly good interview. I'm not a fan of the New York Times. Speaking of declassification, how about Timber Sycamore, which Jeffrey Sachs has said had been mentioned by the Times three times in the decade following it. This was the use of al-Qaeda types to do a dirty war in Syria under the Obama administration. Timber Sycamore. Gabbard actually mentioned it in her hearings for her. One of the few things I would share with her, I would guess, as far as bringing attention to Timber Sycamore.
President Trump.
And to get me, somebody would have to shoot through the fake news. And I don't mind that so much. I don't mind that.
So that's President Trump speaking at a rally. Your thoughts?
I mean, it's hard to fathom how the President of the United States is essentially inviting or condoning violence against journalists. I mean, I think it's terrible.
A victim of assassination attempts himself.
Yeah, and even if he wasn't a victim of an assassination attempt, it is the media, the press plays a pivotal role in our democracy. It has since our country's founding. That's why freedom of the press is part of the First Amendment, and it's the First Amendment is first for a reason. So the notion that the president would essentially encourage some of his supporters who have a history of doing violent things to take out their aggression on the media. And he often does it. That was in kind of generic terms. He often has done it in personal terms. He names people. His supporters name people. And I think it is a really dangerous thing to be doing. And I hope no one gets hurt, but it would frankly not surprise me if someone does.
Talk about Clare Locke.
Clare Locke is a law firm. It was founded in 2014 by Tom Clare and Libby Locke, who were both personal and professional partners. And the firm was created to basically be a one-stop shop for powerful people and institutions that want to take on the media. And so the firm is devoted almost entirely to threatening news outlets and journalists and suing them. And they launched the firm in 2014 at a time when there were basically no other firms that were wholly devoted to this. So it's kind of a risk. And they have, it's just blossomed into one of the most powerful law firms in the country, I think, when it comes to media cases. And both Tom Clare and Libby Locke have developed these ferocious reputations, not only for intimidating journalists and getting their way with journalists, but also, and Libby Locke in particular, has become one of the leading and most outspoken voices for overturning New York Times versus Sullivan, which I think she believes in partly for ideological reasons. She really does not like the media, and she is a Federalist Society devotee, and she's pretty far right. But I think it also it's hard to overlook the fact that her law firm, from a business standpoint, will do much better if it becomes easier to win lawsuits against news outlets. That will be very lucrative for her and her partner.
They didn't start off by winning.
No.
Tell us those stories. Talk specifically about their cases.
Well, and one of the first cases they brought was on behalf of a consulting company called ChemRisk that was hired by, in this case, BP after the huge oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico. And I could say Gulf of America, but I'm going to say the Gulf of Mexico because at least at that time, that's what it was called. There were a couple of bloggers for the Huffington Post who started to dig in to this company, ChemRisk. And what they realized is that ChemRisk had a history of seemingly obfuscating the truth about what about the environmental harms that some of its clients were causing. And so they started writing about this. And it was a very damaging report for ChemRisk, except for one thing, which was that it was published on kind of an obscure blog that no one really would have read. But ChemRisk was very upset about what these two bloggers had written, and they hired Claire Locke to threaten the journalists. And when those threats failed, and when the Huffington Post stood by them, they filed a lawsuit. And the lawsuit, and it ran into a thing called the First Amendment, which protects exactly this type of against this type of situation. And I'm not sure that there was anything wrong or inaccurate in what these two bloggers had written, but even if there was, that is why we have New York Times versus Sullivan. You cannot be penalized legally for writing things in good faith about powerful people and institutions. And ChemRisk and Claire Locke ultimately lost the case, and the attorney for the two bloggers actually got his fees covered by ChemRisk because of a judge ruled in his favor. But again, it was something that dragged on for years. And so while Claire Locke lost, these bloggers kind of did too. I mean, it really turned their lives upside down. Both of them, it was two single mothers, neither of whom really had very much money. And it really exacted a huge personal and financial toll on both of them, even though they emerged victorious. And so Claire Locke, you know, it wasn't a great start for them, but it's still, even in failure, it showcased the enormous power that these legal threats and lawsuits have, especially against people that are not at places like the New York Times.
Talk about malice, what that means and why that is so key in protecting the press.
So the Supreme Court in New York Times versus Sullivan set a standard for how you can win, what you have to do in order to win a defamation case if you are a powerful person, so a public figure or a public official. And they said you have to prove that the person who said the defamatory thing or wrote the defamatory thing acted with what's known as actual malice. And actual malice, it's a bit of a misnomer. To me, I hear that and I think, well, you're mean or you really don't like the person you're writing about. That's not what it means. What it means in the legal sense is that in order to win the case, you not only need to prove that you were defamed and that the facts were wrong, you also need to prove that the person who spoke those defamatory falsehoods knew that what they were writing was false. So in other words, they lied or that they acted with reckless disregard for the truth. And that was a deliberately high bar that the Supreme Court created. And the reason for that was that you need in a democracy where you value free speech and you want people to be able to openly criticize powerful people, which again was what the framers of the Constitution, that's why they created the First Amendment, so that people like the media could be a check on the executive branch in particular of wielding too much power. And if you want people to be able to exercise their free speech rights and you want the press to be a vigorous and independent watchdog, you need to give people breathing room so that if they make an honest mistake or a good faith error, they do not risk being sued to death. Because if you have that fear of being sued to death every time you open your mouth, you are going to shut your mouth.
Where does Alex Jones fit into this picture?
Well, Alex Jones is one of a growing group of conservative voices who have been sued successfully under defamation laws for lying about people, defaming them. And he was sued for a whole lot of money about a whole campaign of lies that he orchestrated against the families of the victims of the Sandy Hook shooting. And he was sued successfully. It basically brought him to bankruptcy.
Explain what he said, what he alleged at the time.
He alleged that it was a false flag operation, that the shooting did not actually occur, that these families that who were grieving and had lost their children had not actually lost their children, and that this is all kind of a conspiracy to enable the government to take away people's guns and to exert more control in society. A vicious completely baseless lie that he knew was a lie.
And all these parents were actors.
Yeah, the parents were actors. It was a really disgusting lie. And he was successfully sued for defamation by these families. And he's not alone. And Rudy Giuliani was successfully sued by two poll workers in Georgia, whom he had accused of trying to rig the 2020 election. Fox News was successfully sued by Dominion Voting Systems because Fox News and its guests were lying about the 2020 elections. And one of the things I hear from people often is that, you know, it's important for libel laws to be able to be used as a tool or a weapon against disinformation and against lies. And I completely agree with that. And I think one of the things that we've seen in the legal climate today is that it is entirely possible with New York Times versus Sullivan to use libel laws to go after people and punish people who deliberately lie and destroy people's reputations. That is, the current legal system is not an impediment to that, and no one's arguing it should be. The question is whether you want to make it so much easier to sue and threaten journalists and others that they are kind of frozen into silence. And I think that is a really dangerous thing, but there is nothing stopping people, nor should there be, from holding liars to account when they cause great damage and kind of threaten our information ecosystem.
I think if you...
And that's an excerpt of a web exclusive, not aired on the regular broadcast of Democracy Now! Thanks for listening. Thanks for enjoying. Remember, there's a demonstration about Mahmoud Khalil Mahmoud, I believe. Maybe I'm reversing the name next Monday noon on the U of I campus on the south patio of the Union. Charlie Kirk is coming to town the middle of next month, I believe, and I think he should have a reception. He said a lot of defamatory things. And, yeah, I might be the operator here. Let's have another underwriting announcement. Tell you you're listening to WEFT, Champagne or Bang.